I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking forward to talking with our guest this hour, who is a leading expert on animal emotions, who will argue that animals do experience emotions like grief and joy and embarrassment and anger, even love. I say he's going to argue that because not everyone agrees with this. We wonder if you do or what questions you have. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Or you can send us an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community. We will welcome your questions for our guests, maybe even your stories about what you have witnessed with a non-human animal who might live in your home, or maybe an animal that you've observed elsewhere. If it's not joy that I am witnessing when my dog greets me at the door, wagging and jumping around in anticipation of her walk, what is it? And speaking of tail wagging, we'll ask our guest about new research that actually studied what it means when a dog is wagging his or her tail. Then again, there are some who believe that a dog who tinkles in the house is doing this to be rebellious or to somehow show anger or resentment for some reason. Is this right? We'll ask our guest, and we'll also ask about the emotions that animals experience and why he thinks it's important that we understand this. Our guest is Mark Beckoff. He is one of the world's foremost experts on animal emotions. He's a professor emeritus of biology at the University of Colorado Boulder, co-founder with Jane Goodall of Ethologists for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. He is the author of numerous books. His latest, The Emotional Lives of Animals, a leading scientist explores animal joy, sorrow, and empathy, and why they matter. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah, thanks a lot for being with us. So there's no doubt to you that animals experience various emotions.
Oh, no, no doubt whatsoever. The evidence is clear from the study of behavior and the study of neurobiology. So
why is it that some scientists seem to resist this?
Well, actually, a lot of scientists, I think, resist it just because some of the things that they do to animals make them distance themselves from animals. They can't believe that they're causing pain to a sentient being. But really, if you look at the trends over the last couple of years, the skepticism and the resistance has really decreased. It's very hard to find a skeptic these days who really wonders whether animals such as dogs or cats or even fish, birds, chimpanzees, elephants have emotions.
Yeah. Let me ask you about is that what I'm witnessing when my dog is jumping up and down and wagging in anticipation of a walk? I'm seeing joy.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Joy, joy and expectation,
mm-hmm.
If you will, going out, getting exercise, having fun, sure. Of that, there can be no doubt.
Yeah. What about, let me ask you about this research that was in the news just yesterday, that I guess researchers were examining a dog wagging its tail. If it's wagging one way, it means I'm very, I have positive feelings. If it's wagging another way, there were more negative feelings. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it's not my field, but I was reading the mm-hmm. same report, and it was interesting because, once again, what they were tying it to is what they call this phenomenon of lateralization in the brain. But what that makes me really think about with respect to emotions is that if humans have this lateralization, which we do, then, of course, other animals do also. So if humans, feel joy and grief and embarrassment, so too do other animals, because we share brain functions. I mean, one of the most cogent arguments for animal emotions is that we share brain architecture across mammals.
Yeah.
So, that's not arguable. So when I saw that yesterday, I thought, well, that's really interesting. Maybe, in fact, this is just another, extension of what we call continuity among animals.
Yeah, it said here that when dogs feel positive about something or someone, their tails wag more to the right side of their rumps, when they have negative feelings, their tail wagging is biased to the left.
Right.
And when you say lateral, that just because right brain, left brain kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so what it means is sort of, excuse me, with the argument about continuity is across mammals for sure, but probably other animals as well. We share structures in a part of the brain called the limbic system, and there's a structure called the amygdala that's important in processing emotions. All the mammals have it, and also a structure called the hippocampus. So, for example, elephants, who now are known to suffer the equivalent of post-traumatic stress syndrome, have an unusually large hippocampus. In other words, it's large, of course, because they have a large brain, but it's larger than you would expect given their brain size. So, you know, that's what we basically mean by continuity. And those facts are just undeniable. I mean, people can deny certain things to animals, but you can't deny the neural structures that we share with other animals.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, why do you say that this study on tail wagging really isn't your field?
Oh, well, I'm not really a neurobiologist.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I actually taught neurobiology years ago, so it's not my field in terms of knowing about different, what they call this lateralization phenomenon.
Yeah.
But when I read it, it does make full sense, of course, in terms of the way in which emotions are processed and in which the brain transmits impulses, you know, so that an animal does a certain thing.
Yeah,
I think it's fascinating because, you know, one of the things I thought about that it didn't go into as a student of animal behavior is whether or not other animals read that as well. We just don't know. You know, I'm sure somebody will do a study now to see whether dogs, for example, respond differently to a dog whose tail is going to the right or to the left.
Ah, interesting. Yeah. But, I mean, do we know, for instance, my dog lady always gets what looks to me like a very sad look on her face when my husband leaves for work every morning. I'm still there, but she is just looks mournful that he is leaving. I mean, do we know that she is showing me sadness?
Well, you know, yes, we do. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can tell from the behavior, but what we also know is that because of shared neurophysiology, not a lot's been done on dogs, but here's another study that's very relevant. If you train rats to expect to play with another rat, then they show changes in the level of dopamine in their brain. And the changes they show are precisely the same changes that humans show. And so, once again, it's by analogy that they would be feeling similar things. But, of course, the other argument, which, you know, I'm a biologist first and foremost, is that just because we say that dogs or cats or other animals feel joy or sadness or, you know, this loneliness when your husband leaves, it doesn't mean that their joy and sadness is the same as mine or yours. Because, in fact, your joy and my joy might be rather different, but that doesn't mean that each of us doesn't have our own flavor of joy.
Sure, yeah.
And that's a really important, it's a really important thing to say because some of the skeptics go, well, surely dog joy isn't the same as human joy, so therefore dogs don't have it. But, of course, you could also argue, well, therefore humans don't have it. You know, we're using ourselves as the measure. But, yeah, if you look at the behavioral studies and you look at the neurobiology, then once again, there can't be any doubt that your dog is feeling something when your husband leaves. It's dog grief, for example, or dog anxiety. And we can even go further. Organizations like the ASPCA have booklets for humans to read so that they know how to treat their dogs when their dog loses a human or another dog companion. So, you know, this grief and the sadness is real.
Yeah, yeah, I have an experience along those lines, too. But then again, for example, a cat, just a mournful yowl in the middle of the night right after another cat companion in my home of hers died. Now, is that grief or is it thyroid disease? You know, I mean, it could be.
Right. Well, I mean, it could be tied into a change in the thyroid. But once again, if you look across species, including humans, they show this type of grief, bereavement, or sadness. So, for example, I begin my book with an observation I made. I was riding my bicycle back into Boulder, where I live, and my friend Rod and I saw a dead magpie, obviously hit by a car.
Mm-hmm.
And what really caught my attention was, you know, you see dead birds all the time, was there were five other magpies around this magpie, and one of them went in and pecked at the magpie's corpse, stepped back. Another magpie went in, did the same, and then one magpie flew off, brought back grass, laid it around the corpse, and another magpie did the same. And this would be the same sort of ritual that you would see in elephants, for example, who are known to grieve their dead.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after I published my book, and after I published this observation of the magpies widely, I was just getting a zillion emails, it seemed, that people across the world have seen similar rituals in ravens and crows, for example. And so, you know, once again, it's this behavior has to be accompanied by a feeling. When I was in Africa, I watched elephants, and I went out and I saw a herd of elephants where they were all walking around with their bodies low to the ground, the ears low, the tail low, the head low. They just looked like they were moping around. And I discovered that the matriarch, the former head of their herd, had just died. And just down the road, there were happy-go-lucky elephants running around, bodies up, tails up, ears up, and if you were looking, happy.
Yeah. What I found interesting about your bird story was that I think a lot of us, so myself included, think about the mammals that have expressive faces and eyes that we think we can read the emotions by looking at their faces, and that's not so easy to do with a bird or a fish.
Right, and that's why we need to go further. As a biologist, once again, and a student of behavior, I say we need to have detailed behavioral observations, and then people are doing some of the neurobiology.
Mm-hmm.
For example, some very recent research on fish shows very clearly that they experience fear, that they're sentient, they're conscious, that they have preferences for, you know, things they do like and things they don't like, which mirror precisely the things that we like and don't like.
We're talking with Mark Beckoff. He is author of The Emotional Lives of Animals. 1-800-642-1234. We welcome your questions for him, or maybe your experiences with an animal, and maybe you witnessed your animal displaying some sort of emotion. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll join Ben Marins this afternoon between 4 and 6 for At Issue with Ben Marins. After 4, Ben will talk with guests about the latest results of the Wisconsin Public Radio St. Norbert College Survey Center poll. He'll be focusing in on what is the most important problem facing the nation today. That's after 4 this afternoon. We're talking about whether animals feel emotions, and our guest says yes. Mark Beckoff, one of the world's foremost experts on animal emotions, a professor emeritus of biology at the University of Colorado Boulder, author of the book The Emotional Lives of Animals. A leading scientist explores animal joy, sorrow, and empathy, and why they matter. Mark Beckoff, why does this matter, whether or not animals experience emotions?
Well, it matters, you know, in a purely sort of educational way. You know, it matters because we're learning more about the world in which we live and coexist with other animals. Excuse me. It also matters because if you're dealing with sentient animals who feel pain and the whole panoply of emotions, then it's incumbent on us not to abuse them, not to mistreat them, not to cause them unnecessary pain. And so, I mean, the real big picture, of course, is why we need to care about what other animals feel, you know, what they think, what they feel, what they like and what they don't like. So
we have lots of callers, so let's go to Joel in Madison. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I could, like everybody, talk the whole show about my dog, but I had a great coonhound for 14 years, and she was a family member, and she died of cancer, and it was in the summer, and she used to lie very quietly from time when she was younger, she was very active, and it seemed like the rabbits in the backyard understood that she was getting sick and going downhill, because they would come very close to her and lie in the grass, and they would just spend hours lying there together.
Mm-hmm. Did you say rabbits?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. You know, when animals die, they give off certain odors. We call them pheromones, chemicals. And there's probably no doubt that there's some kind of shared odor across mammals. So that doesn't surprise me. I mean, we know, for example, that, you know, when an elephant dies or a dog dies, their odors change. And that may be, that may attract attention and release a certain type of behavior. So it's, I mean, what you're saying is fascinating because it just shows that grief could, you know, cross species. And for good biological reasons. So I appreciate your sharing that.
Yeah, thank you very much, Joel. Julie in Milwaukee. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, what a great show. I have had the experience with my dog of when somebody is visiting and is sad or sick, my dog will go and, you know, put his head on their knee or otherwise kind of spend more time and be very gentle with that person while they're in our home. I've also had the experience of apparent grief in fish in my fish tank when the first time I had a dead guppy. I seem to be the only person who can't keep all the guppies alive, but I was going to feed the fish, and they seemed distressed, and then I found the body. They were all kind of huddled in the other part of the tank until I noticed it and got it out quickly, and then they all relaxed and, you know, circulated more. So what you say about smells makes a lot of sense to me. But the most incredible behavioral story I have to share about animals happened to me with a cat who I was visiting a friend, and the friend had a roommate, and the roommate had a cat. And the cat seemed to dislike me, and I was at the time very allergic, especially to cats, and on allergy medicine chronically. And the cat was always rubbing up against my purse and my suitcase and my jacket and my legs and my everything, just rubbing and rubbing. And I was so allergic to this cat, and the roommate wouldn't do anything about it. And at, you know, one point midway through my visit, I started, you know, kind of spanking the cat when I would catch it doing these obnoxious things, and it would do it over and over, and it seemed to get worse. And toward the end of the week, I went to take a bath and had forgotten my shampoo and gone back to my room and left the door ajar. When I came back to the bath, there was a horrible odor, and I couldn't figure it out. I got back in the bath, and I was smelling, where is the cat smell coming from? And I'm smelling in the soap dish, and I'm smelling around. Why does it smell like the litter box? I don't see the litter box in the bathroom here. Where's the smell coming from? And I got out because it was unbearable, and only when I drained the tub did I realize the cat had pooped in the bathtub in my absence.
The cat was telling you something. I mean, the comment you made about fish, though, is interesting because long ago, a German ethologist discovered what they call, it's called the Schreck substance, but it's a stress substance that fish put out in the water, and it's something to which other fish respond. So I'm just saying that your observation about possible grief in fish has a very strong biological basis. So thanks.
Yeah, but what about, because a lot of people experience, I don't know, that situation with cats who seem to hop on the lap of the person who is least wants the cat to hop in the lap. Do you have any talk? Can you address that particular situation?
You know, I can't. I had some students try to study that years ago when I taught a course in animal behavior, and the data were just pretty inconclusive. You know, what they found basically was when we looked at what we collected, it was about, you know, 50-50, 48-52, although we tend to remember those stories when a cat or a dog goes to a person who, you know, the one person in the room is afraid. So, no, I can't. It's something that is reported a lot, but I just don't really know much about that.
The rubbing on her suitcase, though, that's a marking behavior, not necessarily I don't like you because I know you're allergic to me.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It could be a marking behavior with a chin gland, for example, or a gland, you know, from around the eye. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. What about this has never happened to me, but those who believe that a dog who peas in the house is doing that on purpose to somehow show anger or resentment for maybe being left home alone.
Right. I mean, that's possible. It could be also because they're stressed, and sometimes when they're stressed, you know, they tend to pee. But it also could be because it elicits a certain response from their human companion. You know, dogs, like other animals, will often do things just to get any sort of attention. I mean, we know people will do that. But I don't think there's any reason to think that for some dogs, it isn't a way to just say they're upset and they're angry for being left alone.
And then when you come home and they have the guilty look on their face, they know they did that?
Well, I mean, they have to know that they did something that's wrong, sure. I mean, it's something, you know, a behaviorist, you know, somebody who wants to sort of look at animals as, you know, automatons could say, well, they know they did something wrong because, you know, they produced some kind of stimulus, and in the past you came in and you punished them for having peed. I think that in some ways they, you know, the dogs just know right from wrong. They know that they're not allowed to pee in the house.
Yeah.
And they feel guilty about it. But a lot of it just could be tied into they're looking for attention. Yeah.
And you say that animals also experience embarrassment?
Well, there are some really interesting stories. One by a Harvard biologist named Mark Hauser, who saw a high-ranking male who was very interested in mating with a female. As he was strutting towards the female, he tripped into a hole. And he didn't just spring out of the hole and continue his journey. He came up slowly, looked around, you know, as if to see if anybody had seen him fall, mm-hmm. and then strutted off. So it's this awareness that, oh, my goodness, I did something, say, for which I could be embarrassed. And then Jane Goodall also has a wonderful story of a young chimpanzee showing off, as we would call it, if he were a human, and swinging through a tree and then going bam to the ground, getting up, shaking off, and then looking around, you know, once again, as if to see if anybody saw him fall. There's just no reason to believe. I mean, there's no reason to think that certain animals can't feel this kind of embarrassment. Yeah.
Sue in Green Bay is with us. Hi, Sue. You're on the air.
Hi. This is a story a coworker told me. This happened maybe 15 years ago or so at the new zoo here in Brown County. There were two lions that were longtime companions, and one of them died. And then the surviving one, for like the next week or so, could just be heard wailing and, you know, throughout the zoo. You could just hear this real pitiful cry and just droopy walking and just, yeah, it was sad.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I just thought that was, I always tell that story when people say they don't, animals don't have emotions.
Oh, sure. I mean, I've seen this in wild animals, you know, not only in captive animals. In my book, I tell a story about a female fox whose mate had been killed by a mountain lion just down from my house. I live in the mountains, and so I've got foxes and lions, bears, and coyotes around. And one night I was driving up my road, and I saw this big tan animal come towards me, and I thought it was my neighbor's dog. So I started opening my car door to tell Lolita, the dog, go home. You know, dogs shouldn't be out where I live at night. Well, it turns out that just as I got out of the car, I heard Lolita barking behind me, and I went, oh, my goodness, what's happening? And there was a mountain lion right at my car door. So I shut the door, and I drove home, and I have a distance to walk to my house. So, of course, I ran down. The next morning, my neighbor Rob called Lolita's human companion and said that a mountain lion had that night killed a red fox. So I went up to the tops of my steps. Looking down, I saw his mate digging. She was digging pine needles and dirt and, rocks over his carcass. Mm. She would stop. She would orient herself to make sure that she was covering the carcass and do it again. So she was nobody who saw this could deny she was intentionally orienting her body to bury her mate. Then she stood over the mound for a minute and then left. And once again, soon after I published this story, I was just getting emails left and right from people who had not only seen it in foxes, but also there were some observations of wolves. So once again, you know, one of the main messages I put out is that if you see it, it's unlikely that you're the only person who has seen this. Yeah. And I always like to say the plural of anecdote is data, that the more stories we collect, the more credence they have. And now, you know, recognized, you know, world famous scientists are seeing these sorts of behaviors in the wild.
Any evidence of animals experiencing hate, revenge, like the fox going after that mountain lion for what it did to its mate?
Well, very few and far between. One of the classic examples is my colleague Jane Goodall saw in the late 70s, mid to late 70s, one group of chimpanzees, I think it was six or seven males, systematically hunt down and kill six or seven other animals, you know, in another group over the course of a year or so. But, you know, this is just a very rare observation. Mm-hmm. Of course, it tells you that animals can have this hatred and this anger. And sure, animals get angry with one another, but there's nothing on the scale of the anger and the hatred and the evil, if you will, that humans put out to other humans. I think most biologists, most ethologists would agree that we do have these observations, but not on the scale that even comes close to what humans do.
Yeah, it's certainly not hate, but talk about the story I read in your book about the elephants who were looking for a missing pack member that had drowned and they rampaged through a town.
Oh, yeah. Mm. This was in India, and one of their friends had drowned. And in the meanwhile, the Indian community had taken the carcass and buried the carcass. But these elephants went crazy looking for their companion. Mm. I mean, they missed her, if you will, and they were looking for her. And they were very upset, and they did rampage the town. There are a lot of reports now of elephants throughout Africa and even in India, getting angry, if you will, because of the way they're treated. We don't know whether that's really on the increase. We just don't have the database yet. But there are these sorts of observations. So, yeah, it's just, you know, people say, well, do you think they missed one another? And I always say, well, of course they missed one another. I mean, when they're apart, they scream, they search for their companion. And when they're together, they huddle with them, they groom them, they hug them. They sit next to them, and they're quiet and content. So once again, the behavioral data show that, and I'll bet if somebody did, you know, some blood levels of some of the hormones that circulate when humans are grieving, we would find parallel changes in humans.
Yeah.
In animals, I mean, sorry, yeah.
Yvonne in Brown Deer is with us now. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. I'll try to talk real fast because I have a couple of little stories. Two of them involve crows. One morning we woke up to this choir of crows in a tree across the street. Just, well, you can imagine, they don't have particularly good voices. And the neighbor came out and walked around the house a couple of times, and this noise went on and on for an hour or more. And I thought that the crows were acting, that they were very upset about something. So I walked over, and I asked the neighbor what he thought was going on, and he said, well, a crow had flown into one of their large picture windows, and that happens a lot, and was laying there stunned, and he didn't know quite what to do, but he decided to remove the bird, and he did, and the whole time that he was doing that, they were singing, and mm-hmm. So we decided they were canters, and once that the bird had disappeared, they flew away.
Mm-hmm.
The other story I have about crows is sitting on a patio, and we were using paper towels for the kids' napkins, etc. And one was left laying on the table as we were walking away from it. And a crow lit there, took it by a corner, and tried to fly off. And it appeared that the towel was too heavy. And they dropped it on the grass, picked it up again, and tried three or four times. Then another crow arrived, took the other corner, and they flew off together with the towel between them.
Pretty smart.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you see that kind of cooperation, you know, in hunting, in defending food and territory in lots of animals. And, you know, once again, we're finding it in animals like birds, you know, at birds who are being studied in formal experiments. So thanks for sharing. Those are great stories.
Yeah. You know, it seems like it's Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds in My Neighborhood every once in a while, too, with crows congregating in the trees and really making a racket. That behavior can be just, I suppose, they're happy and they're making a racket. It doesn't mean, you know, she was saying that they were doing that because maybe one of the in the flock died.
Oh,
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, you know, they're just doing it because they're, we just say sort of, you know, highly aroused. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're doing it to call attention to get more help for something. Right. Mm-hmm. But there is certainly some, you know, physiological component to it. They don't just do it randomly.
We're talking with a guest who is a leading expert on animal emotions. His latest book is The Emotional Lives of Animals. His name is Mark Beckoff. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. The author of The Nation's Strongest Global Warming Law. We'll talk with Kathleen after 9 o'clock, talking about how California is responding to climate change. That's coming up after 9. We are talking about the emotional lives of animals. A leading scientist explores animal joy, sorrow, and empathy, and why they matter. The title of our guest's book, he is Mark Beckoff, who is a professor emeritus of biology at the University of Colorado, Boulder, co-founder with Jane Goodall of Ethologists for Ethical Treatment of Animals, the author of many different books, including the Encyclopedia of Animal Rights and Animal Welfare. Our next caller is Mary in Janesville. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Joy. I have two dogs, the older dog and the newer dog, both of which were, I'm a great one, I'm a sucker for lost causes. One of them was trained from the Humane Society, older dog. One of them was a neglected puppy who I watched nearly die one summer in a neighbor's yard. He eventually gave her to me. Older dog was in agility training for 2 years. And so older dog, I learned all of the things about why dogs learn the things they do and why they learn the way they do. But the trainer kept telling me, she wants to please you. She wants to do this. And after new dog came, older dog began playing with me like she hadn't before, bringing me toys, doing things with me that were very uncharacteristic, trying to curry my attention. I found it very distinctive behavior. It was all new. Are you there?
Yes.
I guess the point is she definitely was trying to please me. She still wanted to remain top dog. I don't think it was so much a top dog thing in that sense, but she wanted to be my best friend. She didn't want this other person muscling in on what we had.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, you're kind of breaking up on the cell phone, Mary. What do you think of that, Professor Beckoff?
Oh, I think that's really interesting. Sure, I mean, when we live with dogs, we become part of the group, if you will. And, you know, they could curry favors with us. They could, you know, if when I say use us, I don't mean it in a manipulative way, but, you know, use us to reinforce not only the bond with us, but to show other animals how strong their bonds are with us, which is what, you know, animals do all the time, like wolves in a wolf pack or chimpanzees in a chimpanzee group. So, you know, once again, it makes total sense to me that they would have the cognitive abilities to make these sorts of associations.
Yeah. Yeah. We talked about a number of emotions. What emotions do animals feel? Did we miss any?
Well, we talked about joy and grief, pleasure, happiness, sadness. Well, there could be resentment where one animal resents what another animal gets. Mm-hmm. Some of the work I've been doing, which I write about in the fourth chapter of my book, is whether animals know right from wrong.
Yeah, do they?
Whether they have a moral sense. And that's actually attracted a lot of attention, not only among biologists and psychologists, but also theologians who are always looking for, you know, the differences, say, between humans and other animals. And there's been some work done on what's called an equity aversion. It shows very clearly that animals don't like unfairness and inequity and will work to right the balance, for example, and that they may resent when another animal gets something that they don't have. Mm. So resentment, you know, or the striving for some kind of equanimity seems to be present. So, you know, once again, it's just this whole array of emotions. You know, love, for example. We didn't mention much about love, but I mean, nobody can doubt that animals love one another like we love one another. I always think it's funny that we, as humans, think that we have purchase on the phenomenon of love and understanding it, and then you look around at divorce statistics and everything else.
Yeah, swans and their monogamous mate for life thing.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, about 97% of all birds are monogamous,
mm-hmm.
right? And so, you know, I mean, we can ignore those data, but there can be no doubt that you see monogamy, you see pairs mating for life, you see extreme grief, for example, in geese when one or the other member of a long-term mated pair has died.
Then again, there's another species of monkey that's been in the news within the last couple of years that was discovered that they would, like, have affairs on their mate and, you know, sneaking around behind each other's back and having sex. So that goes on in some species, too.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. I mean, nobody's saying that, you know, these other animals are, you know, the pinnacle of virtue.
Mm-hmm.
But it is showing, once again, that there are these, they're called sneak copulators. You know, there are these sneak copulations. There are these, you know, quote, affairs. But in a lot of species, I've got to say, the sanctions for that are enormous. You know, in a sense, if you get caught or something happens, the sanctions in terms of being thrown out of the group or being unable to mate in the future are huge.
Yeah, you told a story in the book, too, about an experiment where I'm trying to remember. I don't remember the animal, but where the animal, in order to get fed, would have to shock another animal and ended up not eating in order to not shock the other animal.
Right. That's actually been discovered in monkeys and in rats,
mm-hmm.
that they will not take food when they know that another animal suffers for their taking food. And along those lines, just last fall in 2006, we discovered that mice show empathy to other mice. And when this was a hardcore, if you will, scientific study published in the most prestigious journal, arguably the journal Science. And, of course, people who have worked with mice, studied mice, lived with mice, know that mice are very sensitive to the behavior and the feelings of other mice. So this just showed that a mouse who sees another mouse in pain feels that pain of the other mouse and shows a lower threshold to pain.
Yeah, and a recent study also showed that mice suffer depression and Prozac helps them.
Yes, exactly, yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, once again, when you think about it, of course it makes sense. I mean, my goodness, mice are used in the billions in research for developing animal models of human disease, for example. But you know what's really interesting, and this is something people don't know, that in 1986, excuse me. In 1986, the Federal Animal Welfare Act in America was rewritten to exclude mice, rats, rabbits, rodents, lagomorphs, birds. And if you read the act, and I actually reprinted part of the act in my new book because I wanted people to see this so that they, you know, they didn't think I was dreaming. It actually says that these animals are not animals. It actually says that rats and mice, for example, have been basically defined out of the animal kingdom.
Yeah.
Let's take
some more calls. Larry in Appleton. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I've got two quick questions, one dealing with a bird and one dealing with a lab. I have an 8-year-old yellow lab that's very loving, and we're training her for a therapy dog, but we've been warned that she might absorb too much of the negative issues around the people that we visit and that she might shut down as a lab. And I was wondering if that's true.
Sorry, would you just say that again? I lost you.
Yeah, she would shut down because of...
The dog would become very moody and very...
In what context? I'm sorry.
As a therapy dog. He was warned that his dog, which is being trained to be a therapy dog to help people with various disabilities, might, get negative vibes and shut down as a therapy dog. Have you ever heard of anything like this?
I don't know. I can't answer that. I don't know much about that.
Right.
I mean, I've been around innumerable therapy dogs who have been extremely friendly and extremely social.
Uh-huh.
But I better not answer that. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I also have a parakeet who has free rein of our house. And twice a year we end up having to cage her up because she spends all her waking moments trying to destroy every piece of paper she can find.
In the classical ethology literature, you find this, some people call it, they call it like vacuum behaviors. And what they mean is that they occur in the absence of the proper stimulus. So sometimes what you'll see rodents do this, you'll see birds do it. One of the strong instincts is to do nesting.
Oh, so he wanted to start a family.
Yeah, well, or it's just this buildup of Conrad Lorenz, who won the Nobel Prize in ethology years ago, called them vacuum behaviors. And what he said is that they just build up to the point where they just explode, if you will, out of the behavioral repertoire. And so sometimes you'll see mice do this or birds do it. They'll just go for the nearest stimulus that might, say, represent nesting material.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll just start collecting all the paper and building nests. So it usually happens when an animal is deprived of the ability to perform some kind of hardwired response.
Thank you, Larry, for the call. Well, my producer, Leo Duran, has a cat that will eat fabric, and I know that this disorder has a name, a pica, I think.
Yes,
but, you know,
pica.
Just kind of, he was wondering, you know, is this an example of a anxious, nervous emotion that his cat is somehow soothing by eating this fabric?
Yeah, it could be, but I think in humans, you know, when they had this phenomenon years ago with kids eating lead paint, I think that they thought it was somewhat related to some kind of nutritional deficiency.
Mm. And
yeah,
that's the same with animals and fabric?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yep.
Jennifer in Casanova, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to touch on the emotions of horses that go to slaughter, if you've had any studies on the ethical research on that, and then also on the dairy cows and the auctions here in Wisconsin, so to speak. Does anybody have any studies or comments on what those animals feel in those situations?
Yeah, there's been a lot. You know, recently Congress passed a bill that was a little more stringent on the Humane Slaughter Act. There's no doubt that horses and cows suffer immeasurably in all different aspects of the food industry, the dairy industry, slaughterhouses. And the Animal Welfare Institute, for example, in Washington, D.C., has been a leader in a number of campaigns to reduce the suffering of horses. And, my goodness, the Humane Society of the U.S., the Animal Welfare Institute, for example, have all been pushing for more stringent legislation on the slaughter of animals in slaughterhouses. I was just at a meeting in Sweden, and a man who's a leader in studying the ethics on the behavior of dairy animals said to me that if you drink milk, you're drinking pain. And this came from somebody in the industry. So I thought that was interesting. He wasn't saying it in a caustic way, but with reference to your question, and this gets back to why animal emotions matter, there's just no doubt that animals in a dairy industry, in factory farming, suffer immeasurably. Yep.
Thank you, Jennifer, for the call.
Yeah, thank you.
Sandra in Fitchburg. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. When I was a little girl, I had a very sweet, quiet little dog, and if you gave it a rabbit, it would lick it and mother it. It would stay by baby's cribs. Well, one day I was outside with the dog, and this cat came and killed this bird, and the bird let out a little shriek. Well, the dog let out this howl, this agonizing howl, and chased that cat, you know, just chased it and chased it, and all the while with this awful, horrible howl. I'll never forget that as long as I live.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, I thought you were going to say, my dog Jethro, I write about him in the book, saved a baby bunny. He brought me back a baby bunny that was about the size of a golf ball, and the mother had obviously been killed near my house by a mountain lion. And then years later, he brought me a bird. And so I thought you were going to go into that, story. But, yeah, I mean, once again, you know, you see these relationships that you think are improbable. I write about a lioness, a female lion in Kenya, who on five different occasions adopted a baby oryx, an antelope, when normally they eat them. I wrote about a dog whose best friend is a fish. And when he doesn't have the opportunity to greet his fish, he gets depressed.
Yeah. Kelly in Madison, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I have a story about my cat. My husband actually has had some experience with behaviorism, and he's done some experiments with, like, doves and stuff like that. And so when we got my cat, we decided that we wanted to teach her to do certain things so that she could, you know, have more stimulus and be more active. And so we taught her the word hit to hit ball and, you know, all this other stuff. And one day, my husband was laying down on the couch, and my the cat was on top of him, and he was petting her. And I was just joking, and I said, "Spooky." And, of course, she turned her head to me, and I said, "Hit." And you could tell that she recognized the hit because she, you know, the word hit because she was kind of, you know, there was a different response with her eyes. And then I said, "Hit Genny." And when I said "hit Genny," because that's what I call my husband, her eyes went completely wide. And so I was just teasing, and I kept saying, "Spooky, hit Genny, hit Genny," and she wouldn't do it. So I went up to her, and I took her paw like I would do when I was teaching her how to hit the ball, and I had her hit my husband, and she immediately got off of him and ran out of the room, and my husband followed her, and she had was totally facing the wall, the corner of the wall, so she was just staring at the corner of the wall, and when my husband came in, she turned around, and she just gave this most mournful meow. And so,
we're almost out of time. I'm sorry, Kelly. So, what did you think this meant?
Oh, I think that she was extremely upset at that. I mean,
No, she knew it was wrong.
she wasn't supposed to hit anybody, especially not Dad. Is that what you mean, Mark Beckoff?
Yeah, I think so, if I got the story right.
Right. Thank you very much, Kelly, for the call. We have all sorts of stories waiting on the line, and we don't have time for them. In 30 seconds, Mark Beckoff, concluding remarks?
Thank you. Number one, we need to respect the emotional lives of animals. Number two, share your stories. And I always tell people, get out and do something for animals. We don't have to do a lot, but we can always do more to make the lives of animals better. So, yeah, activists, aren't we?
Thank you so much for being with us.
Great. Thank you.
Mark Beckoff, author of The Emotional Lives of Animals. He is a professor emeritus of biology at the University of Colorado Boulder. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour. Thanks to Leo Duran for on-air production. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.